Okay, so what I want to talk about today is a paper we've just submitted on a new kind of a thermonuclear event on these AMCAM M binaries that we're calling 0.1As. So the observer should wake up at this point. I'm going to tell you something to look for. They're dim. It's okay. I'll remain nice. So what I want to talk about is pure helium accretion. This is work that's been done with Ken Shen, who's a graduate student here, Nevin Weinberg, who's now a postdoc in Berkeley, was a postdoc here last year in Heisen Elements. So this has to do with what happens on these AMCVNs due to the pure helium accretion onto these carbon-oxygen white dwarfs. Now, let me just give you the punchline, and then I'll walk through our current understanding, which is that we find that there's a flash, helium flash, which leads to an explosion and ejection of something between 0.02 and 0.1 solar masses of radioactive nickel, iron-52, and chromium-48. That yields something that would look like a type 1 supernovae with an absolute V magnitude of these values for 3 to 5 days. So it's a tenth as bright for a tenth the time. And it ends up the rate in an old stellar population, which is where I'll show you we have some ability to estimate, it's about 1/10 the type 1A rate. And when I told Chris Stubbs these three things together like any excellent observer, he said, oh, it's a 0.1A. So I have to thank him for naming them for us. We cannot call it a 0.1A. I'm sorry. We've decided it's a 0.1A. And Jim Liebert has agreed to defend us to the death with APJ. Okay. Okay, so what Chris just talked about was this evolution in a mass accretion rate as a function of orbital period in these systems. And these are for both cold donors and hotter donors. These are the thick and thin lines that he just spoke about. And what I'm going to focus on here is the helium burning that's occurring at very high mass transfer rates, in some sense at very early times, in which the two binaries we likely have that are candidates for that are the two I'll briefly talk about, the two direct impact systems that Stirl discussed. So the scenario we're considering is one where you come in with a white dwarf that's a helium white dwarf that's nearly degenerate or at least partially degenerate. The helium burning is initially thermally stable when the donor mass has this narrow mass range of 0.2 to 0.27. That would be the orbital period. And Tutankhamun and Jungelson have talked about those as super soft sources in the notion of you're transferring helium at the stable rate for burning. But as the accretion rate drops into this range, the helium burning becomes unstable. And there's orders of magnitude remaining of accretion rates to traverse. And so this work we've done came out of asking the question of what happens to the helium on that in those mass transfer rates. So this is a very busy plot. And so I'm going to take a breath before I start describing it. So the first thing to focus on is the mass accretion rate is on this axis. So here we start at very high mass transfer rates, 10 to the minus 6, all the way down to 10 to the minus 9. And the first lines we want to focus on are the donor masses. What's the mass of the donor in these systems? And so if it's a degenerate helium object, it's this dashed line. So as a function of time, the mass transfer rate is dropping as the donor mass is dropping. So that's that curve. Okay. Chris just talked about the slightly hotter helium but still degenerate objects, which would be a line like this. And the helium star, an object that was doing a helium burning, if you will, an SDB star, a horizontal branch star, eventually comes down this way, turns off, burning turns off, and goes on a track like this. So these are three different evolutionary tracks in this diagram of the donor mass versus the mass accretion rate. Okay. So now the first question to ask is, what if my accreting white dwarf is a 0.8 solar mass white dwarf, and I'm starting at this point? This solid line is showing the ignition mass, the amount of mass I need to put on that white dwarf to get an explosion, just to get it to be ignite. These are all unstable. So if I start at this point at a high mass transfer rate, you see I've got about a factor of 10 or 30 in dynamic range, and so what happens is the object is undergoing a helium novae, helium novae, helium novae, but you eventually see you run into a problem, which is that the ignition mass eventually exceeds the donor mass. You run out of available fuel. So the system has some numbers of helium flashes, but then eventually the donor mass becomes less than that you need to ignite. Now, the channel that you're probably more familiar with is the helium star channel, helium burning star channel, where you naturally get very large helium ignition masses. And these were studied in great detail as double detonation scenarios, edge-lit detonation, something we might hear about later in this week. as double detonations, and you typically have ignition masses that are up in this range of 0.2 to 0.3. So what we're going to focus on here is this one last explosive flash, and I've just sort of pulled off different points, and it clearly depends a lot on what the mass of the accretor is, whether it's a 0.6, 0.8, 1, or 1.2 solar mass object. So how do we understand this scenario sort of naively? And let's just look at the plot on the right. Let's not worry about this curve yet. So this shows that same ignition mass from Ivan and Tutikov, which is how much helium you need to put on a one solar mass white dwarf as a function of the mass transfer rate. That's the red line. And this then shows building up the amount of mass that's presently on the white dwarf as it builds up, ignites, starts over. And you see, again, there's a last flash here, last flash here. And these last flashes have these masses of around 0.03. So this scenario, you run out of fuel. Basically, unlike in the helium burning star, where you don't run out of fuel, in these cases, you do run out of fuel. And as you can see, this last flash is actually quite sensitive to the binary evolution, the fact that the mass transfer rate's changing. So what I'm showing you here is by no means the final answer. And I think that we need to make that very clear. But what is clear is you run out of fuel. So let me first tell you then what we think the outcomes of these flashes are. Again, it's a slightly different regime than the typical double detonation scenario. We're getting ignition masses that are almost always less than 0.1. So we're getting 0.02 to 0.1 solar masses of helium on these white dwarfs when it ignites. So here's a calculation from when I graduated from high school by Fujimoto and Sugimoto, which is still remains one of the classic papers showing what happens if I'm accreting at this rate of 3.5 by 10 to the minus 8 on this mass of a white dwarf. So this shows the initial model, and then this is the base of the helium shell going to higher and higher densities. And because they start with a cold white dwarf, the peak temperature is not at the base of the shell, it's slightly off the base of the shell. And so what happens is when it starts to burn, you develop this convective core, this convective zone, grows in time. And you might also notice that because that convective core is increasing in radius, the pressure exerted at the core by that helium shell is dropping. So the core decompresses a little bit. You can see here it goes down. So after that ignition of that shell allows the core to decompress a little bit. And this object became dynamic. And I have to explain what I mean by dynamic. So how do we understand when these helium shells can really give you something more exciting than just the helium novae? Well, so what happens is I start a burning region, I have a convective shell. As time goes by, the temperature at that base of that convective shell is rising. So this is showing the temperature at the base of the shell, the pressure at the base of the shell. So here it starts with a 0.06 solar mass helium shell on a one solar mass white dwarf. As the temperature rises, the pressure is not changing at all. Of course, it's very degenerate material. And you can see it rises up, and then, of course, it turns over, and it's turning over, and the pressure is decreasing. Basically because that shell has become so large in radial extent that the pressure has dropped. That also means that the core has expanded. As you saw in the previous diagram, the core actually expands, so even gravity changes at the base of that shell. That becomes very important, and you get a turning point and a maximum temperature. Okay. If I have a 0.03 solar mass shell, the effect's the same, occurs at a different location, but you can see what happens for that shell. Now what's plotted on here is the time, the inequality, if you will, when the nuclear heating time, which is just the heat capacity divided by the burning rate, and the dynamical time, the time it takes a sound wave to travel a scale height. And that's the solid line. Okay? So for those of you who've done type 1A ignitions, this is similar to when you hand the model off to somebody with a hydrodynamics code. You say, if I have a heating rate that's comparable to the dynamical time, I can no longer do a hydrostatic calculation. I have to hand it off to a professional. Okay? And so for us, this is our minimum shell mass that we're going to talk about. So you see, for a one solar mass object, a 0.06 solar mass helium shell will have some dynamical event. So that line is then plotted on here. Here is this T nuclear equals T dynamical line on a plot showing the envelope mass as a function of the core mass. So if you're a one solar mass white dwarf, you will have a dynamical explosion if the shell mass is in excess of 0.09. That's what that curve's showing. And we also show when it's 10 times the dynamical time, just because we don't actually really know if this is the condition. But it sure tells you where you better start getting worried. Now, what's also shown is this range of this last flash. Okay, the range in which we think that the binary evolution, okay, in these binaries gives you the last flash. That's this hatch region. And this, by the way, is a simulation I just showed you where it happens to sit above this curve. That's where the simulation happened to sit. Here's the mass, not the mass. This is the mass of the object we just talked about, or that was just talked about, the eclipsing, so Tom Marsh and company, the eclipsing object, AMCV, and that's its mass. I'm just showing the mass, not the envelope mass. So we think that because of this intersection of the last flash mass with this dynamics, that for if the white dwarf has a mass greater than 0.9, the likely outcome here is a detonation. For lower mass white dwarfs, we need to do some work. But we decided to forge ahead in the notion of trying to first understand what these types of explosions could look like and calculate the dynamic outcome and the nucleosynthetic yields from these. Now, that pressure range, what's different is we're at typical, so if we plotted on here all of the previous calculations, I have a plot of it, it's later in the talk, basically most of the work has been done up here, just to give you a sense. There's been very little work other than this calculation down in this regime. Okay? And what's interesting, at least was what got us very excited, is if you just ask what's that, the typical pressures of that flash, this is the range in CGS, 2 to 6 by 10 to the 22, that's the minimum mass pressure that's shown here. And this is the constant pressure burning that had been done by Hashimoto in all 1983, showing that at pressures above that and above, you get chromium-48, iron-52, and nickel. Well, that was enough to keep us going, and Nevin Weinberg ran his hydrodynamics code to find out what these ignitions will look like. So this is showing a 0.06 solar mass helium envelope on a 1 solar mass white dwarf. And this is the initial model, in which you tickle it, and what you find is a detonation wave that moves out as a function of time. This discontinuity is the detonation then developing into a shock. And then the CO, this is the CO to the right, what you see is that as you move in, the carbon-oxygen core is merely shocked, but not shocked to a high enough temperature to burn. So you shock the white dwarf, you don't detonate it, but you definitely detonate the helium shell, and here's the resulting nucleosynthesis up to a time of that a quarter of a second. And indeed, we get nickel, iron, chromium. Okay, so what are the outcome of these detonations? So as I said, the helium shell detonation has been studied for much larger ignition masses than what we're talking about. In that case, it easily detonates, the helium easily detonates, and it sends a strong enough shock in to ignite the carbon. That's leading to complete disruption. That's the edge-lit detonation model that you naturally get out of those helium burning star calculations. Okay. And, you know, if you believe the helium burning stars are out there, then these things should occur. The fact that they don't look like a type 1A doesn't mean they're not happening. It just means the observers haven't looked hard enough. Okay? That's the standard scenario for a double detonation. However, we're down from that. We're not igniting that CO core. We leave behind a hot, shocked carbon-oxygen white dwarf, and all that gets out is the helium shell material going out at, let's say, 10,000 kilometers per second. Okay? So, the way you understand those light curves is to basically use the Arnett rule, which tells you there's a characteristic time given by the opacity, the ejected mass, and the velocity. That time is the age of the event past explosion, at which point the diffusion time through the envelope equals the age. Okay, that sets the peak in the light curve. In a type 1A supernovae, that's, you know, 20 days. In this case, because of the much smaller ejected mass, this is 3 to 5 days. Okay? So these events would peak in 3 to 5 days after explosion. So that sounds bad. Okay? The good news is that the radioactive decays are actually still quite active. Chromium-48 is one you all, of course, are very familiar with. It's a 1.3-day E-folding time. Iron-52 is very rapid decay, 0.5 days. And nickel-56, of course, you all know. But the key is that on this time scale, these radioactive elements are still quite active. And so though the peak is briefly after the explosion and it's rapid, it's actually much brighter than you naively expect because you've got all this radioactive heating going on. Okay, so this is the plot you need to stare at. So what I'm plotting here is the peak V magnitude as a function of duration. And here, if you will, is the theorist version of the Phillips relation. Bright supernovae have a slightly longer duration. So here would be something like 91 BG. So that shows the 1As. And then plotted on here are for chromium-48 and nickel-56, both of which have reasonably long half-lives, what's the peak V magnitude as a function of duration? And the parameter along this curve is ignition mass. So this is for a large amount of mass, this is for a small amount of mass. And these are for different opacities, which we don't know yet, say 0.1, 0.2, and 0.4 are the three sets. Okay? So thankfully, the typical event is radiation dominated at maximum light, so it's not crazy at all to use sort of the, if you will, Arnett's rule or Pinto and Eastman to understand what these light curves should look like. At maximum light for the iron, for the chromium-48 and nickel-56, they actually have effective temperatures of 10 to 15,000 Kelvin. That's just an accident. However, iron-52, as I said, has a very rapid decay. And so you have a very thick envelope, then the time at maximum light at a late time, you're out of radioactive heating, and so these objects are actually quite faint. And the crosses here are showing that model, the model I showed you of an actual detonation, showing you what where these things would sit. Okay?
The dotted lines are
the dotted lines?
Including the diffusion and the solids are just the radioactive decay.
These are all just Arnett peak. This is just peak magnitude. That what's going changing along the curve is the mass ejected.
So what are the dotted lines?
The dotted lines are for iron 52.
Oh,
it's pure iron 52, pure chromium, or pure nickel. Okay, so we just sort of wanted to bracket our ignorance, and thankfully it's a log-log plot as well. Okay, so what are the rates of these events? Well, you just heard a whole talk on AMCVNs. You've heard three talks on white dwarf mergers, so how do you do this? Well, you just take the observed numbers. So this is the rough number. If every AMCVN gives a 1A, a 0.1A, that would be about a quarter of the type 1A rate in an elliptical. We view that as probably an upper limit. Okay? So let me show you. So the volume rate, if I have a day, well, actually, let me just show you, next to last slide, what this will look like. So this is showing the 0.1A rate in years for an all-sky survey, right? Because we can multiply by 4 pi. That's easier than using square degrees. Okay, so this is if 0.1As have a rate that's 1/10 of 1As, a volume rate in the local universe, just a volume rate, okay? That's shown by the solid line. That gives you a sense for how many there should be. Okay? Now, at these magnitudes of minus 17, minus 15, minus 13, they're going to be lost in the, if they're following the mass or the light in an elliptical, they're going to be lost in just the de Vaucouleurs surface brightness. Okay? So you have to handle that decrement, and Justin Steinfatt did this for us in the fall. And so what you see here is that they're minus 17, you lose some, minus 15, you lose more, minus 13. But these are our rough predictions of what the rate would be. So if they're at minus 17, we'd get over 1,000 a year all sky. And we've not done the exercise that needs to be done, but I think really needs to be done by those who do the surveys. For all of these current and future surveys with cadences, it would be really nice to run this to get the rates. So what I've hopefully made clear is that the binary evolution with these helium donors naturally leads to these helium shell detonations. Most of them, we think, are basically too weak to ignite the carbon oxygen. The lower ejected mass and this very rapidly decaying radioactive elements gives us these 0.1As, which we think should be found in nearby galaxies and would be the only way you can actually tell you have these AMCVN binaries in these distant galaxies. Everything else you've heard about are things that are in our own galaxy. And we've got a lot of work to do, some of which we're going to do independent of whether the observers find them, which is to understand better these helium ignition masses. We really want to do more of this hydrodynamics. We want to get more robust rate estimates, but you're not going to see the level of maturity in the development of this from the theoretical community that you've seen in the 1As until they've been found. So on that point, I'll stop. We're going to have to run. I mean, we still can run this. I'll let you run this around.
Yeah, I have done similar hydrodynamic calculation in 82, and what we found is at that accretion rate, there still remains a helium layer below the ignition point.
Mm-hmm.
So that creates both outward and inward helium detonation, so it easily detonates the carbon oxygen layer. So if ignition occurs at the real interface between helium layer and CO core, that so-called Subchandra model would work, but if accretion rate is really high, that creates double detonations. classical, but
yeah. So I think Nevin's confirmed some of those statements you've just made. But the main thing to keep in mind is that we are down in ignition masses far from all of the previous studies. So most of what you're saying has been done for where you have 0.2 solar masses of helium on a one solar mass white dwarf. We cannot make that scenario. We cannot make that type of a shell in this scenario. We get much smaller ignition masses. And so for that reason, there's some overlap with previous work, but not actually as much as in some sense we would wish. It actually means we have something to do. And you're right, it depends on where it ignites. So in these systems, where it ignites depends on the prior history. So if you've had a lot of mass transfer, that white dwarf is hotter, in which case the ignition tends to occur more at the base of the helium layer rather than at this midpoint. So that simulation I showed was for one that had just started accretion, had a very cold core, so you get the temperature inversion in the helium shell. We'll see whether we get that. We have a different binary scenario, actually.
Lars, one of the things that would probably help us mirror poor observers, since imaging surveys are the wave of the future, whether we like it or not, and light curves have been and will be collected for these things. Do you have a theoretical light curve for the 0.1As, say, as a function of color, that might allow us to say, wow, that's a 0.1A and not a 1A or a 1B or something?
So I think the simple statement, so one could make this, right? But I think the simple statement, I think I've told you all you need to know, which is that at peak light, it's 10,000 Kelvin, right? That's Vega, and it goes up and down in 3 days. And if you, you know, so that's that hopefully is enough, right? It's not, and in a galaxy far, far away, not in our own galaxy, right? So you get the distance of the galaxy and the, yeah. So you could confuse it, you're saying, with a galactic dwarf novae event. Yeah.
Hi, Lars. When you have this explosion, is the amount of material that hits the donor actually going to unbind the binary?
Maybe. Where's Nevin? yes, that's a really interesting calculation, and it might well shock the donor. It might not unbind it, but it might put some entropy in. It's like Alex is going to tell us if they found them.
Isn't the envelope becoming convective prior to the runaway?
The envelope becomes convective not prior to the thermonuclear ignition. So the simplest, this gives you a good sense of, so it depends on what you mean by runaway. So this is the thermonuclear runaway
Before the time scales for burning become dynamical.
Yes, it's fully convective. It just looks like a type 1A. You've got a full convective zone, and it's happily convecting along. Hydrostatics is fine, everything's fine, and then finally you run into a big problem because of dynamical time. It's very much the same. Yeah. 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 But I'm saying, so let me answer Ken. So Ken's worried about the detonation of this triggering detonation that goes in and detonates this helium, right? What I'm saying is that this was a very cold initial white dwarf, okay? So what I'm saying, we haven't done it yet, but it's a very different calculation in these AMCVM binaries. By this point, you've potentially had 0.1 solar masses added in stable burning. So that white dwarf core could actually be much hotter than this calculation, in which case the peak of the temperature would be at the base of the helium layer. But, so I don't know, but it's different.
So Lars, let me try to blurt this out before I go into a coughing fit. As we discussed when you visited Berkeley, with our Lick Observatory supernova search, we do look at a lot of nearby galaxies. And although I cannot rule out that there are some of these things in the universe, we have not seen any, and only a couple of percent of our supernovae are spectroscopically unclassified. And most of those were not because the light curve went down after just a couple of days, but rather because, you know, there was full moon and no one could get a spectrum, or there was bad weather or whatever.
Right.
So, you know, yep. We have not seen one even that sort of got away, as far as I can tell. Maybe Wei Dong can correct me.
Right.
But there aren't lots of these things in our sample, that's for sure.
So I think the interesting exercise would be to get a mass-weighted rate from your data set.
Right.
And then we could see whether you've actually constrained this or not.
There's one more question.
you were to observe these things, could they be used as standard candles?
Not, I have two answers. The politically correct answer is not my problem. they're dim. They're less. I mean, I don't know why you would want to do that exercise.
Well, you need data sets close as well as far away. I mean.
Yeah. So I we're so far from that problem at this stage that we have to find it. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Yeah, we have to find it. Or I like to say not.
Just a simple question. In the paper, the event took off me and through number, the eco named it, there is a system of the white dwarf plus the helium main sequence star. Yeah. And he said it's a helium cataclysmic.
Yes, yes.
In that case, the mass accretion rate is very much similar to what you said. So it's
so that's
not necessarily the helium white dwarf.
It's this scenario.
Uh-huh. That's so the helium main sequence could be also the helium donor.
Yes.
That's correct.
That's right. So that's this scenario. That's the helium star donors. That's right here. At late times, you can get these ignitions as well, right? Typically, though, those people find that those things blow up and double detonate and edge lit and don't even get down to here because you blow it up, supposedly, right? So that's the old helium star story. You're right. And if those are real, we should be finding them.
Yeah.
Those edge lit detonations, where are they? You know, the Type 1A observers say they don't see them. So I might have the same fate. Yeah. 10 years from now.
Have you looked at the role of rotation in stabilizing this and possibly explaining why you don't see them? Just I'm referring to the work by Yoon and Lange for the more massive ones.
Yeah, so Tony Pyro and I did some work on rotational evolution in the context of white dwarfs and neutron stars. And we find it highly implausible to have the vigorous amount of shear at the depths of the helium ignition that Yoon and Lange desired. So we just don't think that you can basically have this huge amount of rotational dissipation at depth. So short answer is I don't believe it. Yeah, I agree. Correct.
Just to use my prerogative here, since I do have the microphone at the moment, is it also seems to me that maybe some of the microlensing surveys would be, perhaps not yet, but maybe on the verge of being able to provide some information about this. Right, because they certainly have found a lot of supernovae. I think the total numbers they found are probably not yet at the level that they begin to do this yet, but probably in the near future, and certainly early on in PanSTARRS, you should be getting this type of thing.
Yeah, so I'm eager for those who have these surveys to give us estimates of cadences and expected rates. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's something best done by those running those surveys.
Well, that'd be interesting. So, no further questions. Let's thank Lars again.